This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Happy birthday to The Spectator. This week, we're celebrating our 190th birthday. Soon, I'll be talking to a former editor, Dominic Lawson, and our current editor, Fraser Nelson, and we'll be looking back over The Spectator's long life. But before that, it's the podcast as usual. This week, we're asking, do anti-Trump protests achieve anything more than virtue signalling? And are driverless cars on the road to nowhere? Donald Trump will be visiting the UK next week, and after two false starts, it seems as if finally he's actually going to be coming. Next Friday, Trump will be welcomed by Theresa May, as well as major protests. There's a carnival of resistance being organised with special guests such as Lily Allen and a giant inflatable blimp of Trump wearing a nappy. But as Freddie Gray, our deputy editor, asked in this week's magazine, is there actually anything productive from all this virtue signalling? Freddie joins me now along with Shola Moshog Bamimu, a lawyer and activist and the co-founder of the Women's March Against Trump. So Freddie, in your piece you look at the Stop Trump campaign and at some of the events being planned for Donald Trump's arrival. What's on the schedule?
Well, I think it's going to be a carnival of resistance, according to the Stop Trump UK website. I think there's going to be a hell of a lot of different marches going on, a hell of a lot of different protests going on, actually throughout the country, but they're going to congregate in London on Friday the 13th, ominously. And I think it's going to be a sort of jamboree of anti-Trumpism. And while I'm all for people expressing themselves and making their voices heard, I think the whole thing is very silly and actually quite pointless.
Shola, you are the co-organiser of the Women's March. Can you tell us a bit about what's being planned for when Trump arrives?
Yes, the Women's March London is organising the Bring the Noise mass demonstration, which will be happening on Friday the 13th as well, and we'll be marching to Parliament Square. Now, our demonstration is very much about a couple of things. So first of all, celebrating the values that we the British people hold very dear, and the values that very clearly the Trump-Pence administration are looking to stamp on. But also, we have very strong and clear calls for action from a policy perspective, from a political perspective, on what needs to happen in terms of change and what we represent. And in particular, what our government needs to bear in mind when representing us in their discussions with President Donald Trump.
Freddie, you just said you think protests are going to be silly. Do you think Shona's sound silly? And why do you think the protests are silly?
I think there's a lot in the sort of anti-Trump or anti-Brexit movements. There's a lot of stress on diversity and openness. But that involves being not very diverse or open to people who might think Trump has some reasonable points on immigration. I mean, I think that as a country, we are not anti-Trump. He's not our president. And I think most British people can distinguish between the office of the presidency as the leader of the United States, which is a historic and very important ally for Britain, and this orange man who everybody thinks is a bit ghastly and vulgar. And I think it's important to make that distinction. And I think when we fail to make that distinction, we're actually insulting quite a lot of Americans.
Can I flip the script on that?
Sure.
I would say that in the United Kingdom, we are not anti-US, but we are anti-Trump administration, okay? I think people are able to make that very clear distinction. And I think it's really important for us to understand what this is about. History has taught us that when you sit on the fence, you're silent. By your silence, you're complicit. History has also taught us that if you do not take the necessary steps, whether it is by protesting loudly with your voice, using your feet, and protesting by your vote, that quite frankly, you're also part of the problem, not the solution. I think it's all well and good to see activism or people gathering together and be cynical and perhaps suggest that this is not going to make any change. It's just people making noise. Well, the first thing I'll say to that is thank God the suffragists didn't think that when people like you probably said that to them 100 years ago. Thank God leaders of the Black civil rights movement didn't think that when people probably said exactly the same thing. All we need to understand is this. There are real issues affecting our communities, our society, all of us globally. We have to be our brothers and sisters keepers. It is not enough to say it is happening in the United States, it's none of our business, or that it's happening in India, it's none of our business. There are many policies coming out of the Trump-Pence administration that don't only affect the US. Okay, the fact, for instance, that they've pulled out funding for a number of organizations that help support women's reproductive rights and their choices. That doesn't just apply in the US, it applies outside. There are many decisions they've made that affect this. And we can't sit outside going, when you see clear discrimination, when you see clear divisiveness, be it the language or otherwise, and be quiet. That's just wrong.
I think those are all very noble sentiments, but also they just don't make a lot of sense to me, because if you really think that opposition to Trump is silent and these voices need to be heard, I think you're in cloud cuckoo land. I hear nothing but anti-Trump voices in the media. I know very well why people object to Donald Trump. I don't think that there is this constant need to sort of signal our moral horror at what Trump stands for. And I think what it really boils down to is people aren't protesting Donald Trump. They're just showing that they're good people, they're tolerant people, they believe in these values, we're proud of our values.
And I think that's where you're wrong.
Well, no, but I think I'm right. I mean, you've said as much that you want to, you want to show that you stand up for British values, right?
Because I think it's both.
But you want to show it's you, right? You as a person.
Not just me as a person, but all of the people standing in solidarity. What you're missing, Freddie, is that it's both of these things. It's not just people coming to stand together on moral grounds like they have nothing better to do with their time. It's also because people recognize that the issues that they're addressing are important issues. You have to think about it holistically. The United Kingdom, amongst other countries, sit around a table at a global level where the United States will also sit. And the United States is being led by an administration that we don't agree with. We don't align with in terms of values and a lot of things. You can see that in the kind of things that they say at the United Nations, in the meetings they recently just had at G7. The Trump administration has also shown itself not to be an administration where its word is its bond, so to speak. It is really, really important that our government and every other government out there don't get bogged down by a bullish administration. And I think it's too simplistic to look at it from the perspective of, well, this is just about good people talking about how morally flabbergasted they are. There's so much more to this. You have to be able to see it. If you can't see it, I think that there are more people who see why this is important than you do.
Well, I think I hear a lot of talk about solidarity and unity, but I think what these marches and anti-Trump marches and even, you know, the pro-Trump marches, I've been to a few of both, what they're really all about is polarization. And people lament polarization. People even on these marches lament polarization. But what they're actually doing is they're increasing it. They're saying there are all these disgusting, awful people out there that voted for Donald Trump, and I'm showing I'm not one of them. And that is polarizing. That's the opposite of what you're claiming to achieve by standing for unity and solidarity.
That's not correct. I'm going to give you a perfect example. The recent issue of children being caged and separated from their families because of the immigration policy of the Trump-Pence administration. If it was not for the absolute global backlash, not just from the United States, but global, President Trump would not have sat at his desk at the White House and signed an executive order reversing that. Now, I do accept that there are probably other things going on.
No, what's very interesting about that is that children were being separated from their families under Obama, but there was no global horror.
No, actually, because they weren't being separated.
It increased under Trump, but nobody cared when it was Obama.
Actually, the families were put together. Immigration is not an easy issue to discuss. We understand that. We know it's been a problem in that country and also a problem in this country. But the point is that even under Obama and previous administrations, children were not caged.
Come on. The reason people didn't protest against it when it was Obama is because Obama was seen as a good person, as a unifying figure. Rightly or wrongly, that's what he was seen as.
Children were not caged under the Obama administration.
I think actually children were caged.
No, they weren't. I mean, we can debate this till the cows come home or, you know, the moon goes
certainly,
back.
Certainly the zero... You're right that zero tolerance was increased.
Yeah,
right?
But the point is the level of separating children was increased.
And that's what we object to.
Activism is that you are absolutely wrong in saying that it doesn't work. It has no power in itself. When just using this recent example, if Donald Trump didn't give a rat's ass, he would not have signed the executive order.
Moving on slightly, Shay, can I ask you, do you think it's wise to alienate Trump at such a critical time for the UK, given that we're about to leave the EU, we could do probably with quite a good relationship with America?
All right. I think we should take a look at the administration and presidency of Donald Trump so far. President Donald Trump is a leader that acts on his whim, on emotion, and he can change his mind just like he did at the G7, 1 minute agreeing to something, another minute not agreeing to it. The bottom line is this. If this was a playground, what would you tell children to do? Do not be bullied, right? So the bottom line is this. If President Donald Trump thinks that by isolating America, because we're not isolating America, I've already told you, the United Kingdom is not anti-US. If President Trump
is it, and his administration... Is it anti the people who voted for Trump?
No, absolutely not. I mean, we believe in the democratic process. That's not this. That's not what we're talking about. He's already been democratically elected. What people are protesting and marching against are the negative impacts of the policies that come out of his administration that clearly impact on people's liberty, freedom, and, you know, it's absolutely wrong. So the point of the matter is this. People have to pay attention on what the issue is. We should not be afraid that Donald Trump is going to turn around and say, oh, I'm not going to do business with the United Kingdom. Quite frankly, if the Congress of the United States have any sense, they won't even let that happen. Those who are making money out of the trade relations with the United Kingdom probably would not even let that happen. But that doesn't mean we should cower. That doesn't mean the rest of the G7 should cower. Now, what do you do when you are faced with a bully? The answer is not to back down. It's to stand up and confront the bully and stand on your values. So we should not be afraid of whatever decisions Donald Trump will make, because quite frankly, the United States cannot live on its own.
I'm not sure I agree with your analysis, but I agree with the gist of it, that you should stand up to bullies. However, I mean, I think, for instance, that 2 days before Trump comes to London, he and May will be in Brussels discussing NATO, and the British government's very worried that Trump is going to pull out of the commitment to NATO. This is a major concern. You might think that NATO is a waste of time. It may well be. But the point is, this is a very difficult negotiating position. And if Trump is as capricious and as childish as you say he is,
yes,
it's quite possible that after May successfully persuades him to stay committed to NATO, he will then be so insulted by lots of Brits holding up massive blimps calling him a baby, mm-hmm, that he'll think, no, sod you. And quite a lot of Americans will think, no, sod you. Why should we protect the Europeans? Why should we pay twice as much as all European countries put together to protect Western defence interests?
Right, right, right.
So do you see what I mean? It's not just playground tactics. It's actually sort of world-changing politics could hinge on these.
Of course it is. I mean, but world-changing politics play the same as you would on a playground. That's my point.
Yes.
And the reality...
But on the playground, the bully isn't in charge of the most powerful country on earth.
But usually on the playground, the bully usually is the biggest person. And that, if you have to do a comparison, is the leader of the biggest country in the world. But please, let me respond to that. My response to that is this. If Donald Trump was going to change his mind on NATO, he's going to do it anyway. Because
He's impulsive.
Of course.
You just say he's extremely impulsive.
Exactly.
Everybody knows
it.
That's
exactly what he did at the G7. If he's going to change his mind, he would. Is he aware that a good proportion of population of the United Kingdom will be protesting against it? Yes, he is. He was well aware of it 6 months ago. Heck, he was well aware of it the day he got inaugurated into office. So please, that's not going to be a surprise. So if he's going to change his mind on NATO, he will. It's same as he did with climate change, same as he did in retracting the agreed statement with the G7. Please, you should be able to read the writing on the wall when it comes to President Donald Trump and his administration.
Just finally, Shona, can I ask you, do you think there's anything positive about Donald Trump's presidency?
Can I come back to you on that? I don't know, maybe in a year's time. I probably need to
have to process
through
that. Presumably
you do
think it's positive because it's brought together the sort of unity we're going to see next week.
Oh, Lord have mercy. I think now you're trying to put words in my mouth. Maybe when he's democratically unelected or impeached, then we can talk about what positive things, if any, you know, has come out of that. Because quite frankly, the power of activism has led to the awareness and pushed people to do the right thing. That's what I'm talking about. But I probably will need some more time to
get you back in a year's time.
Yes, get me back in a year's time.
Great. Thank you, Freddie. And thank you, Shayla, for joining us.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Uber, Google and Apple. The biggest tech firms have all been throwing billions into developing driverless car technology. We're told they'll reduce congestion, make the roads safer and cut down on pollution. And even the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, has promised that driverless cars will be on our roads by 2021. But are we actually that close to this autonomous future?
Christian Wolmer, the journalist and transport expert, burst the bubble in this week's magazine, writing that really the technology is on a road to nowhere. Christian joins me now, along with the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, Tom Tugendhat, who in his spare time invests in disruptive tech-based startups. Christian, you start your piece looking at this autonomous vehicle exhibition you've recently been at. What was the impression that you got there?
Well, what was extraordinary was this was the Connected and Autonomous Vehicles conference in Stuttgart. And I went along thinking, with my slightly sceptical view of driverless cars, that I would get a lot of criticism, a lot of people kind of naysaying me, saying that I was being too negative and whatever. And what was interesting was that these people were the suppliers of the industry, people who kind of provide sensors, LiDAR equipment, and even test tracks and whatever. And they were all pretty sceptical about the idea that we are all going to be in driverless cars in the next 3 or 4 years, that we're going to have shared use pods instead of our own cars, and all the stuff that the driverless car companies, the tech companies, are kind of putting forward that is the future.
And why do you think they are so sceptical?
Well, I think anybody who takes a proper look at this, and there's been an awful lot of hype, you know, there's a lot of journalists who go on and think, driverless cars, this is wonderful, and actually a lot of politicians who go on and say, well, this is going to all happen tomorrow, it's absolutely wonderful, it's going to change the way we live, it will reduce congestion and blah blah blah. And actually these people who actually deliver that know that the truth is rather more mixed, and indeed I think the whole idea of what they're putting out is unrealistic.
Tom, you are, of course, a politician. What do you think of Christian's argument that the driverless car dream is dying out?
Well, I'm not quite sure I'd put it as dying out. I think he's absolutely right that it's a long way to go yet. The reality is the complexity of an everyday street scene in which you'd put a driverless car is enormous. And that's not even counting in things like, you know, a ball bouncing across the road and whether or not a child will follow it. The very simple complexity of moving in traffic on a motorway is extremely demanding, and it's something that hasn't really been entirely achieved yet. And, you know, so when looking at driverless cars, I am very hopeful, but I'm very hopeful for 20, 30 years out. I'm not very hopeful for in the next 2 or 3 years. Where I'm much more hopeful is actually driverless trains, where we've got some serious progress being made, because, of course, the scene, the road space, if you like, the track, is so much more controllable, and therefore you actually have less variability and a greater ability to control it.
Christian, we tried to get someone from a driverless car company or a technology company to come on the podcast, but we weren't able to. Do you think they're slightly avoiding this discussion?
Yes, I think this is one of the most concerning aspects, actually. There is literally billions of dollars. We're not talking millions. There are billions of dollars going into looking at this technology, testing it out, putting so-called driverless cars on the roads, although for the most part they're not. They have an operator in them. And yet, and these companies are kind of also putting forward and badgering politicians, saying, right, this is going to be the future. It's going to be a completely different world that we live in. And yet they refuse to engage in any way as to some of the problems, you know, whether they be legal, whether they be social, whether they be technical. They won't engage with that, nor will they really kind of engage with the reality of what they're trying to sell us. And I'm worried. I mean, I'm even more sceptical than Tom. I don't think 20 or 30 years will solve this. I think some of the problems are actually unsolvable. And I can give some examples if you want. For example, if you stand in front of a driverless car, the basic law is that it has to stop, right? Because like, otherwise it will kill people. And once you do that, you realise that actually, you know, we jaywalk, you know, we don't even have a concept in this country of jaywalking. You go kind of walking, you know, past Holborn Station at 6 o'clock in the evening. There's hundreds of people on the road and so on. If people realise that all the cars are driverless and they have to stop, they're never going to give way to them. But worse than that, if you really expect that a lone woman will be in a driverless car kind of down some horrid alleyway, the back end of town somewhere, where anybody can stop the car by just standing in front of her. Nobody's ever going to be in one of these vehicles. And there's no, that's not an issue that you can actually get round. There's actually, when I put that to somebody, Professor Paul Newman on a radio program who was actually spent his life developing these cars, he just said I was being ludicrous. Well, I'm not.
Tom, do you think that's ludicrous?
No, I don't think it's ludicrous, but I think one can add manual overrides even to autonomous vehicles. But there are various very serious issues that Christian is raising here. And that's why I think the complexity is so great. And indeed, one of the reasons why I'm a bit disappointed you don't have a company appearing on here is because they are attracting large amounts of investment from individuals and indeed from funds to create things that are frankly not deliverable in the short term. Now, I'm a believer in investing in the UK. I'm a believer in investing in individuals who are coming up with innovative ideas. But I have to say, I'm yet to find something in driverless technology that I'd invest in with any great confidence.
Yes, Tom, I'd rather like it if you kind of persuaded Mr. Hammond of that, because, you know, so far they think they've put on 120 million into this technology. And I think that 120 million would be much better spent, I don't know, improving bus journeys or, you know, making the trains kind of better or whatever, rather than putting it into technology that, hey, if the private sector wants to develop this and think that they can make a lot of money out of it, that's fine. But I don't see why it should attract government funding.
Well, I think that the government's place is to support innovation. And I don't know where this 120 million has gone, but if it's solely gone into driverless cars, I would have thought that was somewhat unwise. But if it's gone into various forms of artificial intelligence and sensor technology and things like that that can have multiple uses, then I think that's rather more in the interest of the country. I think what is something we should be investing very heavily in is, as I say, in driverless trains, and at some point getting towards driverless buses. Because actually, if you have firm bus routes with an override, then actually, again, you're getting into more controlled environments. And the key to driverless technology is controlling the environment around you.
And Christian, just finally, I mean, what would be the issues surrounding this on legislation?
Well, there is a bill going through Parliament at the moment, kind of paving the way for autonomous cars to be used. But I'm very worried that, you know, we're not going to understand what the potential effect of these cars is going to be. And I think, for example, insurance matters are very difficult to sort out. You know, who is responsible? If a driverless car runs somebody over, is it the owner of the driverless car? Is it the people who put in the software? Is it the manufacturers? And so on. There's absolutely really complex issues, quite apart from the standard issue of, you know, how do you program the software? You know, if a child runs in front of it, do you then swerve into the bus that's kind of coming towards you? You know, you might kill more people than the child that is kind of run, you've run in front of. You know, if you have to program it to do one of those things, how do you do it and who is responsible? I think we're nowhere near that. And the idea that, as Philip Hammond said, oh, we're going to get these things on our roads by 2020 or 2021 is quite scary, actually, because I don't want these things on the road by then when the technology just hasn't been developed.
Well, I don't think, I mean, I have to say, I'm not entirely confident that Mr. Hammond's dates are accurate on that. I suspect they may slip right a little, as the expression goes. I think what's much more likely is that we invest very heavily in the form of technology that is required to support these things. And for that, a lot of it's to do with, of course, AI and sensors, as we've spoken about. But it's also to do with security technology, so encryption. Because, of course, these vehicles will have to talk to not only each other, but probably powering networks and GPS networks and things like that. And if you are to have any confidence at all that they are reliable, then encryption to an extremely high level will be extremely important.
Yes, hacking is a real danger, but so is miswritten code. I mean, I spoke to a software engineer the other day who says generally there's a mistake in every 30 lines of code. And some of those mistakes don't get discovered straight away, but they only get discovered when certain circumstances happen. So, you know, again, that is an area where we need legislation to make sure that this code is safe. When you have autopilot on aeroplanes, the code is regulated. It's like standard generic stuff. Whereas here we're talking about cars, AI, developing their own code, which may or may not be faulty.
Thank you, Christian, and thank you, Tom. And now, on to the main event, the Spectator's birthday celebrations. In July 1828, the journalist Robert Rintoul founded the Spectator as we know it today. It was described at the time as a New London weekly paper. And in that paper, Rintoul set out the Spectator's ambition to convey intelligence. In the 190 years since, the Spectator has always been ahead of the times, whether it's in opposing the death penalty or supporting gay rights, long before the legislation was passed. This week, we're putting on our party hats and popping the champagne to celebrate this very special birthday. We're the only magazine in the world to reach such a ripe old age. Joining me now to look back over the highs and lows of the Spectator's history is Fraser Nelson, our editor since 2009, Charles Moore, the editor from 1984 to 1990, and Dominic Lawson, editor from 1990 to 1995, who also writes this week's diary. Welcome to you all. So, Dominic, can you start by telling us what the Spectator means to you?
Well, I have a slightly unusual relationship to it because my father was editor from 1966 to 1970. And I have a very early memory of going to 99 Gower Street, which was then the address. And what I most recall from it and struck me at the time as wonderful was they had those things which you could read about in the Ministry of Truth, George Orwell's 1984 creation, which were these pneumatic pipes which went round from one room to the other. And so corrected copy would sort of go thump and suddenly appear from one room to another. And as a schoolboy, I found that much more interesting than the journalism, the pneumatic pipes. And of course, it was, if you read about the Ministry of Truth in 1984, you read about this. And I had actually read that book.
And Fraser, how about you? What does The Spectator mean?
I guess the funny thing for me about editing The Spectator, I never saw it as something that I personally would bring to the magazine. I've always thought The Spectator's got its own kind of identity. It's a very clear identity, really. And you can go in the basement, we've got all of the archives going back to 1828, and you can pick up any one of them and read the sort of things the Spectator's writing about, how it's writing about it. It's incredibly consistent. When I first became editor, I mean, I had to wait for lunch with Dominic here and asked him lots of questions about it. And I kind of obsessively studied my predecessors and what they did and how they did it. And I sort of worked out that, first of all, it's about good writing more than any party political allegiance. It has to be an illuminating article. Though we don't tend to do party political bias one way or another. Dominic and Charles caused all sorts of problems for the Conservative Party of the day. I guess the toughest thing is finding a surprise, an article you don't really expect to find in The Spectator. And I don't know, Dominic, if you had sort of little tests for an issue every week. I mean, I used to think you need a cover which is going to grab the attention, yeah, but also something that's going to make the reader, because they expect the unexpected, and how you deliver it to them is quite
difficult. Yeah, well, I mean, we didn't then have any kind of advertising budget. It was very hand-to-mouth. And therefore, you had to create a certain amount of sensation, which we picked up by other newspapers, and that would be the advertising, in effect. And actually, because Spectator was always, it's a very popular magazine among journalists and other newspapers, and therefore they never begrudged us our success. They would always acknowledge us in a way they wouldn't maybe with certain other publications where they would just steal it unattributed. They always did well by us. And you're absolutely right, Fraser. The thing that I always felt was, wait, you want one article which is totally unmissable, and people feel, I had to buy it because of this article. And the other thing, again, you're correct, superb quality of writing. And of course, you know, people think of it as a political magazine, but that's not correct. I mean, there's the back half, which is at least as big as the front half, books, arts, personal stuff. And so someone like my wife, for example, not at all interested in politics, but even before she met me, she bought The Spectator because she admired the writing, she liked the arts coverage. And it's a much broader, I always got annoyed when people said, oh, the Conservative political magazine. That always irritated me because it's far, far more than that.
Fraser just mentioned party politics, and Dominic, in your diary you talk about Boris's earliest contribution to The Spectator.
Yeah.
He writes about Conservative Eurosceptics and says they have black, black hearts. What do you think's changed more, the EU or Boris's position?
Well,
on it?
I mean, bear in mind, to be very pedantic, he refers to the European community. The EU did not actually exist then. The Maastricht Treaty created the EU, which was something quite dramatic. I mean, I took a bit of his article, but he was saying these people with black hearts, in a sense, are looking forward to the thing becoming more federalised so that people would rise up against it and leave. And in a sense, the people with black hearts were proved right.
And Fraser, Dominic's diary, he also mentions that this piece that Boris then published, in which he suggested, the writer suggested you were an MI6 agent. Obviously, Boris is now a foreign secretary. Fraser, have you ever had any kind of problems with writing about former editors?
Well, it's always fun to have a little mischief with Boris, always. And I always think that Boris, right now, is a kind of journalist who's been rather miscast as a politician. He likes the fuss, he likes the kind of sense of intrigue. You can always tell when you're reading the papers, and an anonymous quote from Boris, because it's completely, the language is utterly unlike anybody else who'd drop in Pericles or something like that. To me, anyway, one of the strengths of a spectator is looking at his former editors. I sit in Ian McLeod's former desk, I sat in the same one that the Nigel Lawson and Dominic's dad sat on. Behind my desk, I've got a picture of Alexander Chancellor, who kind of rescued the Spectator in the late 70s when its circulation was plunging. And I've always had the kind of great privilege in this job of following and working with my own journalistic heroes. And that's a funny thing of journalists, how many of your journalist heroes tend to be other journalists. And the great thing about The Spectator is that you pretty much get to work with anybody you would like to work with. But people usually say yes to The Spectator when you ask, even though we pay terribly low amounts of money. One thing that hasn't changed over the years.
I mean, I think also, I mean, I was fortunate in my time that the market, weekly magazine market, was generally doing very badly. And while I was editing, or just beforehand, both Punch and The Listener folded. So from Punch, we took a cartoon editor and we could have many more cartoons. And from The Listener, suddenly people like John Simpson, BBC correspondents who previously had an outlet, which they actually were compelled to write in, suddenly I could say to John Simpson, whether he was in Iraq or God knows where, would you write for me? And there was no longer a BBC outlet. This was before the BBC Online, you see. So I was able to pillage two defunct magazines, which folded through no skill on my part, but I was the beneficiary.
And here's me thinking it was your skill. If you look at this again, look at Spectator's history, there have been two massive leaps in circulation. One was under Dominic and one was under Charles. And I think the...
And Alexander, actually.
Well, the funny thing is, if you look at Alexander's, by the time he left, sure, he has turned around and saved it.
He's done the most difficult thing.
Yes, exactly. That hadn't yet translated into massive circulation leap. So I do, you know, credit him with, you know, as building what all of us went on to.
And I think stopping a decline is far more difficult than building on a rise.
Exactly.
And Charles, what was it like editing The Spectator at 27?
Well, a shock for all concerned. But, of course, very exciting. And the advantage of the system that prevailed then was there was no system because we were so poor and so small, which had obvious disadvantages, but it meant you could sort of do it the way you wanted. There were no sort of rules, controls, virtually no management, no nothing. And so you could just sort of walk in and do it. And being ignorant was almost an advantage in that way because I didn't realise how fragile the whole thing was. And I thought, gosh, this is exciting.
You didn't say that when you asked me to be your deputy.
I put it on the rails by then, Dominic. And also, I inherited from Alexander Chancellor a paper that was going in the right way. That's the thing. And so I knew that what I had to try to do was to, rather than turn it round, was to magnify its virtues. So keep sailing on the same course, but trying to get more resources and more people behind that course.
What would you say those virtues are, Charles?
Well, Alexander was always somebody who very much frightened advertisers and proprietors because when they asked him questions about, you know, what his vision and strategy, he'd say, I think I'd like to publish some good articles, laughing. And it's funny how few people really care about publishing good articles, but it does seem to be a pretty important principle and one that's neglected by almost all publications. You know, in a way, that is it, because the point is, it's a very unusual now, a magazine which is a general interest magazine, and it always has been. And the premise behind that is that the reader, because the reader likes the whole thing, the reader will read almost the whole thing, almost whatever it's about. I remember one of the most satisfying reader surveys we ever did, and I'm sure it's true now, is that 80% of the readers read 80% of the paper.
For those readership surveys, I must say I was quite sceptical because I was presented with one just after I became editor, and these things were then quite expensive to do before the internet age, you know, a lot of postage and so forth. And it asked the question, is there too much, just the right amount, or too little sport in The Spectator, and 25% said there was too much sport in The Spectator, which was interesting because there was none whatsoever. And so naturally, the first thing I did was to have a sports column, Spectator Sports, which is now done very well by Roger. Mm-hmm. But I took Frank Keating from The Guardian, and Roger does a great job. And so even sports, you know, can lend itself to a certain lyrical kind of writing, which Frank was brilliant at. So as Charles says, someone might not be interested in sports and they wouldn't read it in the Mail or the Telegraph or the Times, but they will read the Spectator Sports column.
This is what makes it rather difficult to market for Spectator. Every now and again I sit around a table with some, you know, team who's been brought in to try to come up with a slogan for us, and it's almost impossible to get even them to understand what it is if you don't read it. It's not, I mean, I guess we are known for politics because we do politics very well. We tend to depict it on the cover of the magazine. And when you read about us in the newspapers, usually the following up, one of James Forsyth's scoops or something like that. So our non-readers tend to think of us as being a magazine about Tory politicians, which is not a great look. The great challenge is to try to persuade people that it's about so much more than that. And the internet has certainly helped, because you can get people who will come in for one article and then will read three or four others. They'll be really quite good. They wouldn't have expected that they would read them. And so you get people to see for themselves. And the other thing that we do now is we give new readers, I think, you know, it's something like 12 issues for £12 or something. And by the time they finish that, something like 85% will continue with a full subscription.
I think the other thing is, I don't know how it is now, Fraser, but in my time and probably in Charles's, about 30% of the subscribers were not physically in this country.
Yeah, it's about a quarter now.
And many of them were American, and they were Anglophile Americans. And it was the kind of Englishness, one might say. Mm-hmm. And so they idolised Auburn War, for example. Yeah. And I was always conscious that one had that audience who weren't remotely interested in day-to-day British politics, but they wanted something that was, it's a very crude thing, but more BBC World Service, I mean, but something which appealed to that kind of person.
I've often thought that it's the closest thing that England has to a national magazine, and I say that as a Scot. If you think, like, if you did live in, you know...
So that's why you have that accent, is it?
Yes, it's sort of strange kind of hybrid, you know. But when I was going through the archives the other day, I mean, Professor David Butterfield at Cambridge has done this fantastic big history of Spectator, and he was looking at the extent to which the original editor, Robert Rintoul, was inspired
Scottish
Dundonian, quite right, you can see a theme here, was inspired by the Addison and Steele Spectator of 1711. And that sounds a bit bizarre, because that was going to be going for a couple of years, but the Addison and Steele Spectator was republished, and these 12 volume, and were pretty much in every educated household there. And the formula which Addison described it was the pleasures of books, conversation, and the other accidental diversions of life, which I think is a formula which pretty well describes what we are still now.
Funnily enough, in that era, would seem to us an overwhelmingly masculine thing, but the original Spectator was the first such thing read a lot by women, and it actually had agony columns, like Dear Mary.
I had no idea.
And which were all about sort of manners and, you know, how best to comport yourself, or how to behave, and, you know, how to converse, how to sort of say interesting things. I suppose what a sort of Marxist historian would say, this was sort of the beginning of bourgeois history in writing.
Absolutely. So, because when I had this idea of having Mary Killen do a social advice column, Charles, I had not the slightest, idea of that.
And Dominic, how did you go about finding writers for the magazine? Because you mentioned Boris in your piece and Mary.
Well, I mean, there was some, for example, Anne Applebaum, who I always admired and adored, and she was at The Economist, which of course was, well, A, it was anonymous, so, and I felt her name should be shone out. And I tried very hard to seduce, I mean, in the intellectual sense, to come into The Spectator. And there was this big row going on about the exchange rate mechanism, and The Economist was passionately convinced that we should remain a member. And
most publications were.
Almost all. The Spectator, I think, was, apart from the Morning Star, I think there was no other publication that was against it. And what happened was, one evening, the whole thing disintegrated, and she reported being at the sort of ticker tape thing, and the news came in, and all the senior editors of The Economist, looking at this news coming through, slack-jawed. And I rang her up, and I said, Anne, join the winning team. and she did say yes.
September the 16th, 1992.
Yes. And so that was an unusual way of persuading someone. And we had competitions. I mean, Charles was very instrumental in setting some up. So there was a young writers competition. So I mentioned Jenny McCartney, but it was because she won this competition. And I remember she must have been either in her teens or certainly not much out of her teens. And this astonishing article came in. And I remember her father, Bob McCartney, was the leader of a unionist political party and a very interesting and intelligent man. And I remember very ungallantly thinking, her old man has written this. She's clearly not written this. And eventually I was persuaded, and I thought, we have to have, you know. So there's competitions, and you had the travel competition, didn't you? Yes. Ross Clark won a competition.
That reminds me, in fact, yeah. Yes. That,
he came through one of those.
There was the Shiva Naipaul Prize I started because Shiva died.
Yeah.
And our first winner was a young writer called Hilary Mantel.
Yeah.
And I made her the film critic on the strength of that.
And you know,
she went.
And you know, the Ross Clark one, I always remember, because he did a piece. It was meant to be sort of foreign report. He did a piece about how in Texas, with the towards the end of the Cold War, people were turning their nuclear, their personal nuclear shelters into wine cellars. And it was a very interesting piece, and absolutely fascinating. I thought, Soames found this out by himself and got the award, £1,000 or whatever, on the staff. And then afterwards I said to him, local pub, I said, Ross, I mean, that is extraordinary. But you know, no other paper has followed it up. And he said, that's because I invented it.
If there's any consolation, Dominic, I can tell you that my in-laws in Sweden are in possession of a nuclear bunker, as many Swedes are.
Yeah.
And they use it to keep wine.
Oh, so it could have been true, but he insisted it was a complete fabrication. But I felt by then it would be too humiliating to say, we withdraw the prize. It was
all those Pulitzer things.
Yes.
And just finally, can I ask you each what your happiest memory was of The Spectator? Charles?
Oh, help. Very simple thing to say, but always the happiest thing about a magazine is the moment each week hits your desk. So you have actually produced it. You have actually given birth to your baby. And with a newspaper, it's the front page. With the magazine, it's the physical entity of. And it's wonderful to think so clearly, compared with most jobs, that you've so clearly achieved something each week.
Dominic?
I mean, I think I wouldn't single a single happiest, but when a piece comes in which is better than you could ever have hoped for, and you just know that it's a work of brilliance that adds lustre to the magazine and its reputation historically. And that would happen maybe once a year, but you sort of knew it when it happened. I suppose those are my happiest moments.
And Fraser?
I think they're still coming for me. When our sales figures hit their all-time high recently, I was happy then because we're doing so many new things now with this podcast, the internet, so many events, things we never did before. The only purpose of these things for me is to sell and support the magazine, to make sure that this beautiful creation, you know, that Rintel set up, that Alexander saved, that Charles and Dominic built on, is at the foothills of what it's about to achieve at an era where print publications are going down a lot. And for the first 3 years of my editorship, it doesn't seem as if that was going well at all. We were following the rest of the trend downwards. Then it turned the corner, and then it started going up significantly. And right now, you know, we're still, you know, it's not as if we're making shed loads of money, but we're not losing money. We're not on financial life support. And I'm now reasonably confident, in a way that I wasn't when I came on, that The Spectator will be around to celebrate a 200th, 250th anniversary.
And I think generally, I mean, not just The Spectator, but what we're seeing in this ultra-competitive age is actually quality does out. That things of quality, and I mean making demands on readers, are successful. You know, and I think that it's looking more promising than one might have thought in terms of providing something of intellectual repute, because that market is actually growing.
Yeah, and I guess I tried to, you know, rather than modernise it, I tried to just double down on everything which I liked about what we'd done before, thinking that the past was the future, right? Quite a sort of quixotic kind of gamble. And I think the fate of the newspapers has certainly meant that they're kind of struggling right now in a way that we're not. And I think, as Dominic says, if you basically have faith in the quality of writing, then all else will follow. And The Spectator has, for 190 years, had that faith.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you, Dominic. And thank you, Fraser. And that's all for this week. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please do subscribe, rate and review on the iTunes store. We always like to hear from you. And do pick up this week's issue to read all of the pieces discussed, as well as more from Sam Leith, Crispin Kelly and Isabel Hardman. And we've got a special summer offer to help you join the birthday celebrations. Simply go to spectator.co.uk/summer to access 1 month of The Spectator online for free. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.